I'm Kevin Middleton.
And I'm Samantha Berg. And this is The Bridge to Everywhere. Welcome to The Bridge to Everywhere. Join us as we explore health, community, and culture from a holistic perspective. Health topics addressed on our show are for information and entertainment and should not be taken as medical advice. If you have a medical condition, please consult an appropriate care provider.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to The Bridge to Everywhere. I'm Kevin Middleton. I'm here with Samantha Berg. And tonight we're going to speak with Joel Carter. And Joel has a vast and varied background, and currently he's a volunteer at Hospice of Mat-Su, doing grief counseling and visiting the terminally ill and also offering group facilitation. Joel was a former Methodist minister, and he spent a lot of time really in a deep investigation of the spiritual life, his own, and also in counseling with others. And today we want to talk a lot about the process of moving through life's challenges, deepening one's spirituality, and integrating that in a culture that is increasingly complex, deeply needs spiritual rootedness, and yet is changing and evolving all the time. And within this process, there's what's called the dark night of the soul, and ever-looming possibility of our own death. And the more we can face into that and really, really look deeply at the meaning in our life and what we're here to do, a lot of the answers start to become clear. And I think Joel has a lot to share with us today.
So before we start with Joel, I want to give you a little bit of a sampling from the biography he sent us. And so Joel was born in Asheville, North Carolina in 1947, so he's 65 years old. He was raised on a farm near Mount Pisgah. He graduated with a BS in Business Administration at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill in 1969. He graduated with a Master's in Divinity at Duke Divinity School in 1972. He served four parishes in bounds of WNC Conference?
Western North Carolina Conference,
mm-hmm. 1973 to 1991. He graduated with a Master's in Culture and Spirituality from the Institute of Culture and Creation Spirituality at Holy Names College in 1987. He moved up here to Alaska in 1991, where he served as a job coach with developmentally disabled adults from 1991 to 1994. He also served as a director or case manager at the Dorothy Saxton Runaway and Homeless Youth Shelter from 94 to 95. He worked as a self-employed handyman from 95 to 96. He served as a counselor with victims of the Miller's Reach Fire in Big Lake, Alaska, which from 1996 to 97. He served as a professional counselor at LifeQuest, currently Mat-Su Health Services, from 1997 to 2007, and he worked primarily with persons who are diagnosed with borderline personality disorder. He received an internship in the Art of Spiritual Direction from Mercy Center, Burlingame, California, 1996 to 1998. And then in 1999, he received a bone marrow transplant in June from the Fred Hutchinson Cancer Center Research Center in Seattle, Washington. And we're going to talk a little bit about that. In September 1999 to the present, he's actually been dealing with a chronic graft versus host disease. He retired from work in 2007, and he's currently a volunteer at Hospice of Mat-Su, visiting terminally ill, grief counseling, and group facilitation. He meditates daily and attends weekly group doing centering prayer, and he's a student of Zen Buddhism. He also has two daughters, ages 41 and 35, who live in North Carolina. And is that son of 16 years who lives in Palmer? Is
it significant other?
That sounds young. Significant other, 16 years, who lives in Palmer, and he lives in a yurt in the middle of the woods in Wasilla. So welcome, Joel. That's quite an extensive biography.
Well, thank you.
So we have a lot of different directions to go, but what I would like to talk about a little bit is your experience first going through the bone marrow transplant and cancer, because I know a lot of people in our audience either know somebody in their family or are personally dealing with it. It seems like we just see so many cases of cancer, and it's just escalating every year. So I'd love for you to talk a little bit about that experience and what that was like for you and how it's changed you.
Okay. It was quite a frightening experience initially to be told that you needed to have a bone marrow transplant. I remember when I was first diagnosed with the disease, I went to Cars and bought a fifth of Jack Daniels, you know, just to kind of see if I could drown it away. But it didn't work. Anyway, I was diagnosed with myelofibrosis, which is a fairly rare blood disease. I think the people at Fred Hutchinson told me that there were only like 28 cases out of 900 transplants that they had had up to that point in 1999. It was caused, they say, it was idiopathic, which means that they really had no, they didn't know where it came from. I came into contact with a toxic substance sometime in the past 30 years, which could have meant anything, I suppose.
And I know some of the blood cancers, like lymphoma, are connected with chemical exposure, so it's right. possible, but they don't really know like what it could have been.
Yeah, and it was interesting. During the course of my four-month stay in Seattle, I was told that there were seemed like to be an inordinate number of cases coming from Wasilla, Alaska, and they said, what's going on in Wasilla? So I don't know what, I don't know if something's been buried there that we don't know about or what.
Well, it's interesting that you say that because we had Dr. Michael Ellenberg, who's a naturopath in Anchorage. He did a lecture in our office in last February on cancer. And somebody in the audience stood up and said, you know, I called a friend of mine in Midwest and I said, what's going on with all these cancer cases? It seems like everybody I know around here is getting cancer. And the person in the Midwest said, I don't know what you're talking about. So I haven't really looked, you know, that's just something I observed. I haven't actually run the numbers, but, it's interesting that you're saying that too, that there seems to be a slightly higher incidence of cancer around here. It's something I want to look into and do a little bit more research on.
Right. Well, yeah, that's what they were saying at the Fred Hutchinson Center.
And that's back in 99.
In 99, right.
Joel, what were the symptoms you're experiencing?
Well, not really much except anemia. And so I went through this battery of tests to try to figure out what was causing the anemia.
Okay.
And they found out that it was myelofibrosis. And so when I went to Seattle in May of 1999, I'd never been to in a hospital. I mean, I'd been in a hospital hundreds of times, sometimes as a chaplain, visiting other people. But I'd never been a patient in a hospital at 51 years old, so it was a pretty frightening experience. And I was in the hospital for 25 days, had massive doses of chemotherapy, and I had blisters all the way from my throat, all the way down through my system, and my immune system was down to zero, so I picked up an infection at one time, and it was amazing how fast it hit me, and
they actually wipe out your whole immune system on purpose, though, right?
Right.
To do the transplant?
So when you put in the transplant, it won't kill it. Your body won't kill it.
Right. So they're trying to kill the cancer, and they're just bringing you to the brink of death so they can do this transplant,
exactly.
Right? And then they hope that they can bring you back.
Exactly. And my sister, you know, the other thing is that's very interesting is that there's a 33% chance if you have a sibling that sibling is a perfect match. And I have one sister, and she was a perfect match, which means that she lined up on six different genetic factors. She and I did not have the same blood type, but she lined up on those factors. And she chose to give me her stem cells instead of a bone marrow transplant. Mm-hmm. And for those two reasons, because she was a female donor and because she chose to give me stem cells, it meant my chances of getting chronic graft-versus-host disease was greatly enhanced.
Oh, that increased the risk.
Yeah, right.
Okay. And how do they collect the stem cells?
They just a transfusion from her arm, and they put them back in.
So it's a blood transfusion.
Blood transfusion.
So it's not like a where they go into the bone actually
No, it's not. At that point, you know, my spleen had been producing red blood cells up to that point, you know, to kind of help out. But your spleen was not meant to produce blood cells on a long-term basis. But anyway, my bone marrow was not, it had a fibrous material in it. It was displacing the ability to make red blood cells. Anyway, my two daughters were my care providers. They stayed with me in Seattle for 4 months. And I left Seattle in September of September 1st, actually, of in 8 days later, maybe 9 days later. Anyway, 103 days after transplant, I got really sick with diarrhea, and I think I was sick for about 8 days, and finally I got so dehydrated I went in the hospital, and they told me I had chronic graft-versus-host disease.
And so what is that? Could you explain that a little bit for people?
It's simply put, it's your body trying to kick out your transplant.
Mm-hmm. So your body's rejecting the stem cells?
And it manifests in all kinds of wonderfully amazing ways, and I'm being facetious.
So do you have to take immunosuppressant drugs?
I do. I still am. I still am. I'm still on, like, I'm tapering, but I'm on 20 milligrams of prednisone every other day. And it hit my lungs in 2000, like January of 2000, and it wiped out a third of the ending of my bronchial tubes.
And it's in the lungs.
Right, yeah. The lungs. And so my breathing has been compromised ever since. It's hit, it's done things to my hands, as you can see. That's graft versus host. I have chronic dry eyes. I had sores for a period of time. I had sores on the inside of my mouth that were so, I guess, bloody, you'd say, that I couldn't even have dental work done for a couple of years. And finally, that went away.
So your body's in a constant state of trying to fight something off, and
right.
That's something that it's trying to fight off is actually saving your life.
Right, and I was told initially in 1999 that a third of the people would get rid of chronic graft-versus-host in 2 years, a third in 4 years, and a third would die with it. And, of course, I've still got it.
Uh-huh, so you're making that third.
They're saying they're seeing signs now that it's actually going away. Mm-hmm. So I'm in the process of, I still have it, I know I have it, but I'm in the process of tapering off of prednisone so that maybe at some point I can.
Yeah, so that's 14 years though, you've been through a lot physically, so I'm sure you can relate when you're in a hospice scenario or even when you're dealing with somebody who's chronically ill and seeing what kinds of things they're going through. It sounds like you've probably been through it.
Well, I think, for me it was a wonderful experience. I had a couple of affirmations that my daughters had placed on my wall in my hospital room. One of them is that nothing goes wrong in my life, only good manifests in my life. And embracing a positive attitude that there's something to learn here through this process that I wouldn't have learned any other way. And I think for me, I have a philosophy that, there's things that we learn through suffering that we don't learn any other way. And, I look back on it as being an absolutely wonderful experience of, not only being able to bond with my daughters, but having so many expressions from people, even in my former parishes, who reached out across the United States to me, in giving me pastoral care that I'd never received from I'd always given it. I'd never received it. And to me, that was just a marvelous experience.
Did it test your faith?
Not really. There was another minister from North Carolina who had a bone marrow transplant the same time I did, and he died. The real problem with the bone marrow transplant is that if it hits your liver, you're toast. I mean, you really are. If you hit your liver, it's just a matter of time till you go. And it hit his liver. And for some reason, it didn't, I took the other route. I got chronic graft versus host disease, and it's done some damage to my liver, but I'm still living after 14 years, thankfully, and certainly have. And I learned that, to me, that life is such a gift. It's such a wonderful, wonderful gift, and there's no guarantees, and that each day we live is a gift, and it's, to be met with gratitude, that it's not something we've earned or merited. It's a gift, and so I'm extremely joyful at every day I live.
Do you think that we need to have a crisis to wake up to that fact?
Do I think we do?
Yeah.
Well, I think if we're human, we're going to have crises, and we're going to have problems. And I think we simply need to look at these as transformative events. And I'm not sure what I even mean by transformative event. they're invitations to entertain the mystery and come out of it with some kind of intuitive knowledge that you didn't have before. And this is not logic. This is not logic. This is not intellectual. This is something that you feel deeply within you.
What do you think it is about some people can go through an experience like yours and they wake up and they change, and other people can go through the same experience and be, wow, I'm so glad that's over. I'm not going back there again. Mm-hmm. And then they turn their back on it and, you know, it was almost like it never happened. So what do you think that difference is?
Well, I mean, you know, I think we can choose, to ignore the hand that life deals us. But I think that life keeps knocking at the door. And at some point in time, it'll get our attention. And I think basically, you know, these events are invitations to get our attention and to move us in the direction of an inner journey, you know, to move us in that direction. Not some, you know, I think meaning is not particularly found out there in our materialistic mm-hmm. society or in all the things we can accumulate. You know, our inner journey is absolutely the pearl of great price.
You know? And it sounds like you think life's going to just keep giving you that pearl until you accept it. Keep trying to hand it to you in different ways
until you
notice
it. I think
it,
so. And I don't think we're limited to this life mm-hmm, in that
right.
either. You know, I mean, you know, who knows what's next, mm-hmm. but it's the hound of heaven will continue.
I like that.
If one may call it, will continue to pursue us, although I use that advisedly, that phrase.
You know, I understand that you're practicing Zen Buddhism now, and I'm wondering if you might say a little bit about your transition from a Methodist background to appreciating more the mystical dimension of Christianity, as I understand it, and also Zen Buddhism.
Whoa.
Segue in it just to telling us about what, you know, what brought you into the Methodist Church in the first place, and then why you said in 1984 that you had, that was sort of when you had started to think about leaving the church and looking for the door. So maybe just talk about that transition and
I became a Universalist in the Methodist Church in North Carolina in 1980, probably around 1982, which means universal salvation basically, and started preaching from that context. And of course, when you start preaching from that context in a buckle of the Bible Belt and survive, you're doing pretty well, I guess. But, you know, I was sincere in my belief in that. And there was a growing number of universalists, I guess.
Could I ask about that? Universalists? Because I grew up Jewish. So does that mean that everybody has the opportunity to be saved? Everybody will be. So it's not that
there's nothing that's lost.
Okay.
Okay, so this whole idea of this dualistic understanding of heaven and hell it's just what it is. It's dualism. It's a false myth, you know, from my perspective. And so, you know, and then in 1984, the General Conference of the United Methodist Church came out with a tenet, I suppose you'd say, that, it's okay for lay people in the United Methodist Church to be gay and lesbian, and it's not okay for ministers to be gay and lesbian. And I kind of went, what? You know, because ordination in our church, to be ordained a minister as I was, means that you're set aside. You're a lay person who's been set aside to do a separate task or a different task. There's no difference between laity and clergy, but they were saying there was. And to me, that was classism in the worst kind of form. So I started looking for the door of the church at that point. I went on sabbatical in 1986-87 and spent some time with Matthew Fox's Institute of Culture and Creation Spirituality a year or 9 months out in the Bay Area, which was an absolutely marvelous experience. And the educational experience there was the best educational experience of my life. And it was a wonderful experience. And so I went back to North Carolina and tried to, with a partner, and tried to set up a creation-centered parish. And we did so with some success. But the church now is just marvelous. It's a marvel. You know, I attended it last year, and it was just, it's become the Glide Memorial of the East, which is a wonderfully diverse community that's thriving. You know, when you have a Muslim Jewish community center in the middle of Winston-Salem, North Carolina, you've really got some kind of magic going on. So it was just, it gave me hope and faith in the possibility of the church, you know, which I...
And you said there's an incredible diversity of the people who attend the church. It's all denominations. It's different sexual orientations, different colors, different backgrounds.
Hispanic,
you know, rich,
black,
poor,
white, gay, and lesbian. It's just a marvelous collection of humanity, all gathered in a community, which I think is the kingdom of heaven manifest on earth. So anyway, the question I get.
How do you go from there to Zen Buddhism?
Okay. For me, I think, I can't really talk about Zen Buddhism, I don't think, until I talk about sort of a dark period that I went through. Because when I came here in 1991, it was not long after that we built... My partner and I built some yurts, and three of which I live in now. And then we also built Day Spring Community Retreat Center in Wasilla together. And
is that still here?
It's still here. And Day Spring comes from Gerald Manley Hopkins' poem, talking about Christ being a day spring to the dawn, to the dimness in us. And my partner and I decided we didn't need to be together. And I decided after 2 years to quit attending the Methodist Church. So it was a very painful time because when I left the church, when I went on sabbatical, that year of sabbatical was, my first wife and I had separated after 18 years of marriage, and we had two daughters. So it was a very painful time. And so I had not really grieved two significant relationships in my life. And I grieved the loss of the church. And so it was a very dark and lonely time. And my spiritual director at that time suggested at one point that I was journaling periodically, but I started journaling I think every day for like 6 months, and I never have done that again. But it was a wonderful experience. I could do it as a handyman because I didn't have a job. I worked 32 hours a week as a handyman, but I had plenty of time to be able to journal every day. But, it was just, it was a very gut-wrenching, lonely, dark time. And I call it, the dark night of the soul. I remember having a dream toward the end of that experience. I'm sure I was depressed. I'm not sure I was clinically depressed. But I can remember having a dream of coming up to, of riding a tricycle and coming up to a group of trees and having to leave the tricycle behind because it wouldn't fit through the group of trees. And so I kind of swung between the group of trees, and I looked down, and here's this humongous pit before me. And I sit there and kind of went, how in the world am I going to get across this pit? And all of a sudden I saw three people appeared. One was a kind of a homely looking woman who in Jungian terminology I would say is my anima. And there was this kind of muscular looking man, and that would be my animas. And then there was this little child, which would be my inner child, who went down into the pit and explored around there. And then all of a sudden, from out of nowhere, there was this grapevine that came to me, and I grabbed it, and I swung across the pit, and I looked down, and I saw all this ice, frozen stuff, and everything, and I swung across to the other side of the pit, and I got out in this road. The sun was shining, and here came my three people that had gone down in the pit. They came and joined me on the road.
So I know you have a couple of poems that you wanted to read about Dark Night of the Soul, but it sounds like what you're describing for that experience is it's a place where you get to in life where you feel simultaneously disconnected from purpose, maybe, and also stuck. Like, there doesn't
right.
seem to be a direction to go.
Right.
So, and the only direction you can go is going to take you deeper into the pit,
and
possibly.
And,
yeah.
And it almost seems like the boat that brought one to that point in one's life has to be left behind, and something new actually has to arrive in the picture to move
right.
forward.
Right. It was funny. One time, I used to go out in this field and meditate in the mornings. In the wintertime, I'd sit on this stump. One morning I went out and I said, I'm going to see the sunrise this morning. This was in the spring of the year. Snow on the ground. I sit on the stump, looking at Pioneer Peak and the mountains behind it. Well, I saw this huge glow coming up behind the mountains, and the sun never came up. It just kind of drifted along down the mountains. And I sat there for 2 hours, and it never did come up. And I said, yes, sir, this is a metaphor for my life. So I walked back home and left the meditation.
One of the people who we really admire, who did a lot before he died, he was a counselor, he was an engineer, and then he did a lot of peace process kind of work, like working with populations of people who had, you know, historically hadn't gotten along, like Palestinians and Israelis. And he made the metaphor.
Dane and Perry.
Yeah. He talked about how somebody, like, you're on a trapeze and you're holding on to one side of the trapeze, and then you grab the other side, but you have to let go of the
right. You have to let go of one
in order to go to the next place. So it's like, otherwise you're just sitting there with one hand in the future and one hand in the past, and there's nothing you can do. You're completely stuck.
Well, another dream that presents that when you say that is I had a dream of this great big white chalkboard, or, you know, that I was hanging on. I mean, it was like a sign on the side of the road, one of these huge signs, and I was hanging on the top of it with one hand. It was totally blank, and I had a magic marker in my hands. Nothing on it.
That's great. Could you read the poems that you brought?
Sure. This is a couple of short poems.
Oh, okay, wait. Actually, I take it back. We have to take a break right now, so we will be right back. You're listening to Bridge to Everywhere, and we're having a conversation about Dark Night of the Soul with Joel, and I've got his Joel Coulter.
Carter.
Carter, Joel, sorry. Carter. Joel Carter can read your writing. We'll
so
be right
stay
back.
With us. We'll be right back. Thanks.
You're listening to Radio Free Palmer, KVRF 89.5. If you'd like to get involved with community radio, contact us at radiofreepalmer.org. This is your chance to invent community radio in Sutton, Butte, Chickaloon, Palmer, and the surrounding areas. Big Cabbage Radio!
Welcome back, everyone. You're listening to Bridge to Everywhere. It's Sam and Kevin here, and we're having a conversation with Joel Carter. And we were just about to have Joel read a poem. So I'm going to have Joel. Actually, I think you've got two poems to read in reference to Dark Night of the Soul, the discussion we've been having. So go ahead, Joel.
Well, these poems occurred during they occurred both in January of 1995.
And these are poems you wrote?
Right, which when I was journaling every day for like 6 months, which at the end, at the behest of my spiritual director at the time. Anyway, the first one is called The Table Inside. I long for the bliss of love fulfilled, but where does this food for my soul come from to feed this hunger in my heart? I have tasted the wine of flesh entwined, only to see the thirst return. Could it be that I seek and settle for cheap wine, when all the time the real vintage is inside? I hear souls call to come, sit and dine at the table inside. The best food and wine are served by a mysterious host, and the hunger and thirst are no more. The second poem is entitled Day Spring. The day opens like a flower. The sun breaks forth like the gentle stirrings of the bud. The light pierces the darkness with welcomed intrusions and bathes the branches of trees in soft gold. To see the splendor of dayspring is to taste the nectar of God, a moment frozen in time to be referred to again and again in memory's album. O dayspring, illumine my life that I too may bathe in soft gold and walk the caverns of time with memory's warmth.
Those are beautiful. Thank you. What I heard in the first one and then leading into the second one is that, you know, I think everybody could identify with this sense of longing in their heart, looking for something. Right. And, you know, the culture that we live in, it's materialistic. So we look for that fulfillment outside of ourselves, you know, in relationships and the things that we have and the ways that we identify ourselves. And yet there's, no matter how much of that we get, you know, according to what society says is valuable, there's still, after a while, we're going, that hole's still there. We're still looking for something. And so it sounds like, you know, that poem is saying that it's that connection with God, that connection with understanding that we're not separate. You know, that ability to see ourselves as one with everyone else, with this place that we live in. And then also the piece about bringing the light in is really interesting, that there is, I think a lot of people think that we have to make the darkness go away. And what you really have to do, and we talked about this last time, actually, it's really just as easy as opening a window and bringing in the light, and then the darkness goes away.
And there's something else in that I hear, which is, In the yearning, you know, the inclination is to seek out there, you know, and Sam was saying in things and objects, the culture tells us this is where you will find fulfillment. And it doesn't necessarily occur to us to deeply dive to the source of that yearning, where mm-hmm. the miraculous discovery is that what's seeking is what's sought, that source of yearning is itself, perhaps, God reaching out to us. And if we might have the courage to seek within, and mm-hmm. I hear that, you know, deep, what we could say is a non-dual discovery that mm-hmm. we've never been separate from the very
right.
deep source.
Exactly.
I actually joke sometimes with people that yearning, which we're in some ways we're also conditioned to drown it out, you know, with a particular substance. You know, for some people it's substance abuse. Other people it can
right.
be with pharmaceutical drugs. You
right.
know, and I'm not saying there aren't people out there who need pharmaceutical drugs. I just want to be clear on that. But
right.
but there are some people during a bout of mild or even moderate depression, that voice that's calling out, that yearning, you know, I feel like they're ignoring it. I want to make that voice go away. And it's actually, no, what Kevin's saying, you turn into that and you follow that where it leads back to source. It's not something that you want to make go away, because it's actually a source of growth and change.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
When you wrote those, Joel, was that a turning point? When you wrote these poems, was that a turning point where you were pulling out of this dark night and a new life was starting?
Yes, it was toward the end of the process. Yes.
Mm-hmm. And so we want to go back to, so from where you were, that we've got the dark night of the soul and you're coming out of it, and then how that led you to Zen Buddhism in the end.
Well, you know, I transitioned to it, I guess, and I went to the Science of Mind Church in Anchorage for a while, you know, maybe a couple of years, just to kind of try a different system. And actually I attended a church here in Palmer, the Church of the Covenant, from like 1997 until probably 2005, and, you know, I was drawn to it because it was the only welcoming and affirming church in the valley, you know, welcoming gays and lesbians, I mean, and because I long for a community of diversity, and so often in the church it's difficult to find a community of diversity. you know, all that time over the years I've been meditating, and you know, probably a Buddhist form of meditation, you know, where you attend, you sit and you attend to your breathing. And
that centering prayer, is that?
No, that's just Buddhist meditation. Okay. Centering prayer, which I've been involved in, I was a part of a group in 2004 through about 2007, and we did centering prayer, which is a Christian form of meditation. And the only difference between centering prayer, I guess, and let's say Buddhist meditation is in centering prayer, you have you use a sacred word to focus your mind on so that you don't chase thoughts, you know, and use that sacred word as kind of your mantra, right? Whereas Buddhism, or, you know, most Buddhists use your breathing, attend to your breathing, and I still find it more comfortable. I tried the sacred word for a while, and it just didn't seem to serve me as well as the attending to my breath. But, you know, I feel like that in terms of accessing this inner journey, that meditation is the way to go. I mean, you know, you have to have silence. You have to sit and be still. I think of one Buddhist master, I guess you'd say, who said you need to meditate, or you need to do zazen, I guess is the way it's pronounced in Buddhism, as if your hair is on fire. You know, I mean, that's a mandate, you know. Yes. And I think if we want to really access ultimate reality, not the relative reality that we're, this dualistic reality that we're all swimming around in, if we want to access ultimate reality, we have to sit, and we have to be quiet, and we have to meditate.
Yeah, there's a saying that if you're too busy to meditate for half an hour, you should meditate for an hour. And we teach a meditation class, and we notice that the transformation that's possible in that meditation class with people that we've in some cases we've known for a really long time, it seems like that then when people take on that practice of just sitting in stillness, it opens up the door for so many different transformations from the smallest thing to, like, yesterday we had somebody report just as a teacher that she felt like she was nicer to her kids.
Right.
She noticed the ability to be nicer, and somebody else said, you know, I noticed that my relationship is changing with my husband. You know, there's a potential for tolerance there that
right.
hasn't been there before, and that there's an ease around the way we relate to our own stuff and the place that we get stuck, and there's an ease about the way we relate to other people, and it creates an open-hearted space.
Well, I think that's exactly right, and I think for you know, centering prayer. I think the name centering. You know, you enter the day, if you start out in the morning meditating, you enter the day more centered. You enter the day more mindful, more in the moment, which is another tenet of Zen Buddhism, or Buddhism in general, to be in the moment, to be mindful of the moment, and to be aware as you go through life and not drift through it accidentally, you know, bump into things, you know, but, you know, do it with intention. And I had another thought there on the benefits of meditation.
I've got a couple points I wanted to drop. One is just what we're aware of in teaching meditation is that, you know, we really always have a diverse group of folks with different spiritual orientations and different life experiences and different stages of life. And across the board, meditation enriches equally. You know, it's absolutely the universal, you know, salve, I guess, for the heart, to open up the heart, to open up one's inner vision.
Right.
And so along with that, why, Joel, why do you think there's such resistance to stillness? That it promises so much, that it makes so much possible, and it's the simplest thing, yet it is the most, there's tremendous resistance to be still.
I think there's a lot of fear in our society. You know, all we have to do is turn on the television, and the news broadcasts make their money on peddling fear. These events, you know, that they peddle, you don't hear these happy, joyous things rarely. You hear these tragic, awful things. And I think, you know, we as a Western culture, I don't know what it is, but somewhere along the way I heard that we imported anxiety from Europe, you know, with our ancestry. And I think there's a great deal of anxiety among our Western society that perhaps other cultures just don't experience the way we do. And I think for that reason, we try to fill up the sinkhole with things, you know, with alcohol and drugs or with materialistic things. And that's problematic. That keeps us away from taking this inner journey, which is entirely necessary, I think, in order for us to, I don't think, know the true joy of living. Yeah.
Absolutely. You know, and that is the universal discovery when one does go deep into meditation, is that life is good. It's somehow, you know, despite all the, you know, there's no denial of the tragedy, the difficulty,
right,
the adversity, but somehow there's this profound discovery that underneath it all, it is okay. It is good to be here. It is good to be alive. And there's a buoyancy and a sort of vitality, a refreshment that one then brings into their life anew, a
right,
strength.
And that, you know, like, you know, I'm sure you've heard the Chinese word for crisis and opportunity being the same word. And at least I was told that.
It's anyway, sort of, but we'll it's not quite, but we'll take that for now.
Yeah.
The meaning is good.
Something
along those lines.
And in great crisis comes great opportunity. So,
right.
Yeah.
And that's it. You know, there is an opportunity. Anytime we have be wounded in this life, there's no way of getting around it. We can't insulate ourselves from problems. What we can do is embrace them and say, you know, what kind of lemonade am I going to make out of these lemons that have suddenly appeared in my life? You know, try it. And this is, you know, I'm an optimist, but this is not Pollyanna stuff. This
right,
I think, is really being engaged in life in a vibrant, lively way where you, you know, and I think, you know, the thing that reminded me a minute ago when you were talking about this journey is that I think I have this image of a well inside of us. And I remember having a dream one time where I was pumping sand out of my well. You know, I said, well, there's something wrong here, you know. And I think of all these little rivulets that come into a well that's healthy and vibrant, and it fills up our well. And I think one of the adepts, I think it was Bernard of Clairvaux back in the 10th century, talked about giving from our... be like a reservoir, where a reservoir overflows and we give from our excess rather than give from our substance.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, the mystery, I think, is that when we take this journey inward, there is a corresponding journey outward that's not forced. It flows out of us. So we become embodiments of loving kindness. We become, you know, in the Christian context, we become living embodiments of Christ in the world.
And that itself is a spontaneous expression. It's not an effort. It's
right,
just flowing forth.
Right.
And it has it seems to have a quality of greater inclusivity.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, inclusivity,
mm-hmm,
not
mm-hmm,
exclusivity.
Right, exactly. That, well, and I think that's to me the journey of in Zen Buddhism, and it's contained in the Kabbalah, you know, it's contained in Sufism, it's contained in all the mystical traditions throughout the world, that, you know, that we're all connected, that there is no other, that we're all, that there is no sacred and profane, it's all sacred, and that, you know, when I see you, I see me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like namaste, except you take away the mm-hmm, necessarily, you know, the God. I see the God in me as the God in you, or I just see you. You know, you're me, and that, you know, when I do harm to you, I'm doing harm to me. And you know, we access that reality when we take the inner journey, I think. And otherwise, we're just mending fences, aren't we?
Absolutely.
So I would love to move from that into some of the hospice work that you do, the volunteer work that you do, mm-hmm. because hospice work, to me, it's really sacred work, and it's so needed in our culture because you talked about fear a few minutes ago, and I think one of the biggest fears is we're so afraid of the fact that, you know, this body ends that most of us don't want to look at it. We don't want to go there, and it's a part of life that, I mean, it's pretty much guaranteed if you're born, you die. And yet it's a part of our life that we really don't look at all. Not many people really, unless they're forced to face the fact of their own death, they don't really look at it. And so a lot of things happen in the end of life, you know, a lot of decisions that aren't made because people didn't want to go there, a lot of all sorts of things that people go through mostly because they're the inability to face it before it happens. Mm-hmm. And one of my mm-hmm. teachers likes to say, well, if you're not willing to die before you die, you'll die when you die. Mm-hmm. And it seems like if we were actually living from the place of acknowledging that, you know, we are mortal, that we do, like really getting it, that we die, life would look a lot different. So I would love for you to talk about some of your experience in hospice work and what it's taught you and how it helps you to move others along in that journey.
Well, I think, you know, life and death are part, you know, that's another thing I think that Zen Buddhism affirms, is that life and death are a part of the same coin. You know, it's just one side of the other, you know, heads on one side, tails the other, life on one side, death on the other. It's all a part of the same package. And that there is no separating life and death. And, you know, I don't think we need to embrace the prospect of our own death, but I don't think we need to, what's the word I'm looking for? We don't need to catastrophize about it or let it become an all-embracing mm-hmm. thought to us, you know, that, you know, living, life is just for living. But I think the prospect of grief, when grief happens to us, when we lose someone dearly, or when we're terminally ill and we're facing our own death, there's this big hole, I think, opens up inside of both people, the griever and the grieving. And that, you know, this hole is a fearful reality. And to be able, I love the poem, are you familiar with The Guest House by Rumi?
I know some Rumi poetry, but that.
Oh, you've got to get a hold of The Guest House. Rumi, in his poem, The Guest House, talks about this, embracing, you know, every, talking about our emotions, every day a new arrival, and embracing these, even if there's some sorrow that comes and sweeps out our whole house. Embrace them and welcome them, you know, like sit and have tea with them at your table, you know, because there may be a messenger from beyond. Mm-hmm. And I think we need to look at grief that way. Grief can be tremendously transformative for people if we embrace that hole inside of us and not try to run from it. I mean, I've seen over the years in the parish ministry, I've seen people who would try to cover up their grief with drugs or whatever, and alcohol, or just try to avoid this process.
I have the poem so I can read it.
Oh, great.
So The Guest House by Rumi. This being human is a guest house, every morning a new arrival. A joy, a depression, a meanness, some momentary awareness comes as an unexpected visitor. Welcome and entertain them all, even if they're a crowd of sorrows who violently sweep your house, empty of its furniture. Still treat each guest honorably. He may be clearing you out for some new delight. The dark thought, the shame, the malice, meet them at the door laughing and invite them in. Be grateful for whoever comes because each has been sent as a guide from beyond. Rumi.
Right.
That's beautiful.
Well, and what that poem says to me is that we need any emotion that we entertain, whether it be anger or grief or fear or whatever, we embrace that. We don't push it aside. We don't slam the door in its face. We welcome that emotion into us because there's a gift there waiting for us if we do that.
One of the things I think about with that is that on one hand, we do obviously, just find an incredible liberation in just accepting, right? So that just a radical acceptance of allowing life to be as it is, because actually it is as it is. So, we can...
We might as well deal with it because it is.
Now, and there's another nuance here, which is to not identify and attach to what's happening. So in some way it seems like, yes, the emotion moves through, but if the emotion is grief and then I attach and I identify with that emotion and get stuck there, then the movement stops happening. Any thoughts about that? If allowing things to move and happen, but not, I am not that grief. I am not that transient experience. There's something much deeper about who I am.
Right. The thing that pops into my mind is Jesus on, I guess it was Mount Horeb, on the Mount of, in the Bible, it's talked about as the Mount of Transfiguration, where this voice of God comes out of the cloud and says, "You are my beloved Son with whom I am well pleased." And here's Peter, James, and John are sitting there watching all this. This is the myth, okay? And Peter, after all this experience, of God speaking to Jesus and Jesus being transfigured there before him, Peter goes up to Jesus and he says, Lord, let's build three booths here, one for you and one for Moses and one Elijah. Moses and Elijah appeared with him too. And so let's build three booths here, And, the church has been doing that ever since, instead of being transformed, we build buildings of brick and mortar. We can put our hands on that, but all this kind of stuff that we can't touch, we shy away from, because we're, I don't know, are we afraid of it? Are we...
I think that this deeper pointer that you're showing is not a thing, and so we find confidence, we find, some kind of support in objects, and that's just our habituated nature. But what you're pointing to is not a thing. It's something that is experienced, has no lack. It's profoundly self-contented, self-revealing, self-evident, but it's not a thing.
And who we are at our core is basically consciousness, right? It's just pure awareness. If you take all of our social conditioning, our gender conditioning, our family conditioning, our geographical conditioning all away, and all we are is just, we're just awareness. And I think that's a hard one for, especially in a culture that doesn't really put a lot of emphasis on spirituality. It's hard for us to grasp that. So we want to go back to something that we can hold and touch and say, there it is.
Right.
We want to point to something and say, ah, that's it. But it's something, I don't think it's ever something that you can, the classic line that the Tao that can be spoken is not the Tao. You can only kind of approach it with words. It's something that you have to experience.
Right. That's the whole invitation, I think, with emotions. The emotions we counter in grief, these are not something you can reach out and grab and hold and say, look, I've got loss right here in my hands, see what it looks like. You can't, but the invitation, I think, there is it's difficult for people to say, folks, you need to embrace pain. You need to hold pain and cradle it like you would a baby in your arms. And let it stay with you until it goes away. The guest that comes into Rumi's house is, I'm sure they pat each other on the shoulder after they've had tea together, and we'll see you again at some point in time because that emotion will be back around, but somehow you're transformed because that emotion is a friend now.
And in Chinese medicine, the grief is actually pointing at the fact that you had something precious. So that the intensity of that emotion is actually honoring that thing that you had, whether it was a thing or it was a relationship, whatever that loss is, the intensity of the grief is actually, that's the pointer back to that, back to that thing that you had. So it's in some ways, it's like until you lose something, you don't realize what you had. And that grief is, in fact, the pointer to the immenseness, the amazingness, whatever that connection was for you. That's what that emotion is pointing to. So it is pointing right back to that thing that you feel like you've lost.
Yeah. And that brings me to the thing of Zen Buddhism. There's a saying about, the hand pointing at the moon is not the moon. And I think this is a human problem. Mm. you know, we make an idol out of the hand. You know, we make an idol out of the hand pointing at the moon. You know, becomes our idol. You know, the Bible is our idol, or our concept of some sort of religious leader. It is the hand pointing at the moon. These are all people that pointed at the moon. They weren't the moon. And, you know, sometime we'd have to talk further about this whole idea of in the ancient Jewish tradition of Yahweh,
Y-H-W-H.
Yeah, it has no vowels in it. And I was told there's a couple of reasons behind that, but one was that the ancient Jews did not made a word that was not pronounceable, so that because they believed if you gave God a name you could pronounce and you have power over that God. And so I'm taking a different rabbit, but anyway, I think we, I guess when I look at the moon and try to call it God or something, that I think giving the moon a name, you know, limits the power.
Yeah.
Sure. And anytime we point at something and we think even to another person, like, oh yeah, I know that's Kevin. You know, I've been married to Kevin. I've been with him for 24 years. I know everything there is about Kevin. That's just Kevin. Right. I put a label on it and he's in a box and then that's it. I don't have to change my relationship with him. He's not going to change. I'm not going to change. It's fixed. But life isn't like that. You know, there is no fixedness to it. But as human beings, you know, with our small minds, that's our way of orienting around the world. It's okay. I understand that. Check. And now we can move on.
You know, I think the capacity for advanced cognition and abstract thought, you know, has given us great gifts in the world. The capacity to anticipate the future. I mean, really, it's been the very mechanism of our survival, you know, from a evolutionary standpoint. And yet here it seems that, you know, what you're speaking about is tasting the meal rather than just spending time with the menu. But it's just oh so delicate, a very subtle thing, because the mind will serve up a facsimile that we take for the real thing.
Right.
And so it takes great discernment to actually, oddly, for some reason for us, to dive into direct experience, to actually directly experience rather than to settle for an intellectual facsimile. And so some kind of a construct the mind generates that keeps us maybe a little safe, even if it's just a delicate inch or two away from the experience. Maybe there's a little safety there.
Right, right. And so a mystic is someone who believes in direct experience. And the Kevin you knew yesterday is not the Kevin you wake up with today.
Ever fresh.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, so it looks like we have one more minute to go.
Any last words you'd like to share with our listeners? And if folks have any questions for you and want to follow up with you, how would they get in touch?
I don't know. Life is for living. Embrace life. The invitation to meditate, you know, as a way to access ultimate reality. Not thinking that your life is going to change in any great way. You know, you chop wood and carry water. And of course, I don't believe enlightenment is a phenomena that we somehow reach. I think we're all enlightened beings. And the invitation is to recognize that, to awaken to that, to embrace that, and let life happen.
Beautiful. Joel Carter, thank you for joining us tonight. We'll be rebroadcasting the show on Wednesday at 5 p.m. for those who are just catching the tail end of this show.
Thanks for joining us, everyone. Have a great evening. Bye-bye.
Thank you, Joel. Thank you for joining us on The Bridge to Everywhere, broadcasting on KVRF 89.5 Big Cabbage Radio in Palmer, Alaska. Like us on Facebook at Bridge to Everywhere to access more information, links and resources from our guests and show topics.